Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
America, welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for listening in. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, David. How are you? And good evening to everyone out there. We have another informative program tonight. I want to remind veterans and other listeners that this is your show. It's called the Veterans News Hour. So if you have a question or comment, call us now or during the rest of the show at 888-627-6008. Again, that's 1-888-627-6008. And David, we have a very nice guest tonight, don't we?
Yes, we have a special guest on our show tonight, John J. O'Brien, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who currently is the Army Post Historian at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Before talking with him, though, we will first have a few minutes of some up-to-date news about the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs.
That's correct. Let's start with developments in Washington, D.C. This past week involving the VA, on Tuesday, February 28th, the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees held a joint hearing to receive the legislative presentation of the veterans group, the Disabled American Veterans. Then on Wednesday, March 1st, the committees held two more joint hearings to receive the legislative presentations of the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the American Legion. We will be discussing their presentations in greater detail in future weeks on this show, but this evening I want to summarize their views on an important issue we have discussed in past weeks, and that is the reform of the VA disability appeals system. All three of those groups, the DAV, the VFW, and the American Legion, agreed that reform is needed in order to deal with the huge backlog of disability appeals now pending at the regional offices and the Board of Veterans Appeals. As we discussed in prior weeks, there are bills pending in the House and Senate which would create new procedures for handling appeals. The bills would change the present decision review officer process by eliminating the decision review officer's obligation to receive new evidence. Even more significantly, the proposed legislation would end the VA's current legal duty to assist veterans once an initial decision has been made. Currently, that duty to assist exists both in the initial claim development as well as through the BVA appeal stage. The various proposed bills would eliminate that duty after the VA makes its first decision. Apparently, all three of the major veterans groups which testified this week support major reform, although it remains to be seen to what extent they will be willing to fight any attempts to cut veterans' rights. One of the more perplexing positions was taken by the commander of the Disabled American Veterans Group, David Riley, whose written statement to the committee said as follows, and I quote, "The appeals modernization framework included in legislation introduced during the 114th Congress would provide veterans with multiple options and paths to resolve their issues more quickly while preserving their earliest effective dates to receive their full entitlement to benefits. Notwithstanding some questions regarding legacy appeals, by which he apparently meant the nearly 500,000 cases presently under appeal, appeal equitability, duty to assist, planning, and implementation that will have to be resolved before enactment or during implementation, it's time to move forward with this vital reform. While we strongly support enactment of the appeals modernization legislation, the DAV will not compromise any aspect of the system's pro-veteran nature for the sake of the streamlining the system. The due process protections and duty to assist rights currently afforded to veterans cannot be diminished. In order to protect them, any uncertainties relative to reform efforts should be resolved through clear statutory language. Therefore, it is essential that Congress fully fund, faithfully implement, and aggressively monitor this new appeal system. Once enacted, to ensure it achieves its intended purposes while fully protecting veterans' rights. I would point out that the legislation he was referring to from last year was passed by the House but not acted on by the Senate. That legislation contained the many problems we had previously discussed. Therefore, it seems contradictory and terribly misguided that the DAV supports similar legislation this year while acknowledging but not solving the major problems with that legislation. It would be a major mistake to pass the proposed changes and then expect the appeals backlog to be fixed. In fact, we predict the proposed law would make the present situation much worse. In our view, those bills reflect the desire by the Department of Veteran Affairs to cut its workload by cutting veterans' rights. We will be following steps taken by the two committees, and we'll be reporting on those events in our future shows. Meanwhile, we urge listeners to pay attention to what is going on in Congress because it will affect current veterans as well as future veterans. Thanks to the Internet, it's relatively easy to monitor Congress. Check out the websites for the two committees at veterans.house.gov/ and www.veterans.senate.gov/. Another very valuable way to track pending legislation is through the website www.govtrack.us/. And that's about it, David.
Richard, that's great information. Thank you very much. And as you said, we will be monitoring developments in Congress, and we'll be reporting on them in our upcoming shows. Now it's my privilege this evening to introduce our special guest for tonight's show, who will be discussing the history of a very famous Army installation, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. John J. O'Brien is uniquely qualified to be our guest tonight. He served on active duty in the Army for 20 years, primarily in infantry assignments. He retired with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. After his retirement from active duty, he has continued to serve as the installation historian at Fort Campbell. He is a graduate of the University of San Francisco with a bachelor's degree in government. He has a master's degree in political science from Lincoln University and a master's degree in military art and science from the Army's Command and General Staff College. He is a doctoral candidate in U.S. history at St. Louis University. He has also served as an adjunct faculty member of the History and Philosophy Department at Austin Peay State University, where he teaches U.S. history and directs a senior internship in public history. John is the author of the definitive book on the history of Fort Campbell, published by the History Press in 2014. It's our privilege to have him on the show tonight. Welcome, John.
Hi, David. How are you?
Great. It's so great to have you on our show tonight. I'd like to thank you for your many years of service in the Army and to our country. And I'd like to start by asking you to tell us more about your Army career, your assignments, some of the most memorable events in your career, if you would.
Well, David, I was fortunate enough to be commissioned in the United States Army in 1977. And to put it in a nutshell, I spent about half of my career in Europe in the height of the Cold War before 1989, serving with the 3rd Armored Division and the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I found myself back in the United States for the second half of my career, where I served mostly with the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell.
I see. And what would you say makes Fort Campbell unique today, not only among Army installations in our country, but in fact around the world?
Well, I think what we pride ourselves in at Fort Campbell is that the 101st Task Force 160, the Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and the 5th Special Forces Group, all of which live and train and deploy from Fort Campbell, are some of the most active and most frequently deployed units in the United States Army right now. So it's a place where there's a lot of activity and a lot of contact with what's going on in the world today, especially with the United States Army and its many deployments around the world.
Right. Would it be fair to say that the troops at Fort Campbell are really the tip of the tip of the sword?
Well, we have an awful lot of good units in the United States Army, and I wouldn't want to overlook anyone, but the 101st, the Task Force, and the Special Forces Group are among the most elite of our vertical envelopment forces, and that would be the way that they get to work, so to speak, is through the air. The Army helicopter and going through the third dimension to strike the enemy where least expected in his most vulnerable area is the specialty of the units at Fort Campbell, and they really work hard at maintaining that expertise.
Great. Now, for the benefit of our listeners around the country who've never been to Fort Campbell, how would you describe Fort Campbell in terms of perhaps its location, size, surrounding communities, those sorts of things?
Well, it's located almost in the geographic center of the United States. Most people don't think of Kentucky as being there, but we're only about 400 miles away from the center of the contiguous 48 states. So we're centrally located about an hour north of Nashville, right on the border between Kentucky and Tennessee. As a matter of fact, the border of those two states bisects the installation. And just a little note, how unusual, more unusual that is, in the building in which I work, my telephone numbers upstairs are Kentucky area code, and my telephone numbers downstairs are Tennessee area codes, because the state line goes right through the building.
Wow.
It's a beautiful area, very rural, rolling terrain. It was originally selected to become an Army mobilization camp because it looks so much like the central European terrain, which, of course, in World War II, the forces that were training at Fort Campbell were training to fight in Europe. So that rolling farmland that was characteristic of Central Europe is also characteristic of the area that we reside in.
Wow, that's interesting. Wow. What are your current duties now as the post historian?
Well, I work for the U.S. Army Center of Military History and work with the history programs at Fort Campbell. Part of that involves doing historical research. Whenever we get ready to go somewhere, it's always nice to be able to take a look at how we performed in that area before and if we had done a similar mission set. So we'd want to take a look at the lessons learned. A part of what we do in my office is we collect the current history so that we have it on hand for when we need it in the future, and related to your program and the story of our great veterans, we need to collect that story every time our soldiers go to the field. So we do that. And then we also run a museum. And from that museum, we concentrate on sharing with our current active duty soldiers, our veterans, and our family members the history, heritage, and values of the units that we serve at Fort Campbell. So it's a three-part mission, and it's very exciting, and I feel very privileged to be part of those three functions that we perform for the soldiers at Fort Campbell.
Well, it sounds like from one of the functions you mentioned that there truly is the intent to have a benefit to the mission by studying perhaps past action, after action reports, past lessons learned, and making sure that those are not forgotten. I think that's important.
Yeah, and if I could just make an example of one of those types of lessons learned. In 2003, when I first was working as a historian or in the capacity of a historian, I was asked by General Petraeus, who was the division commander at the time, to take a look at the lessons that we learned in Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm in 1991. The types of things that we learned just by looking back at history was that if you take a retread tire on a Humvee and take it to the desert and put it in 120 degree sands, the adhesive will melt.
Wow.
So before going to Iraqi freedom in 2003, Having learned that lesson, we made sure that every tire in the division was brand new and was not a retread. Otherwise, we would have had a horrible disaster with tires falling apart. And it's just a simple lesson learned. There's nothing really complex about that. But you tend to forget those things over time. So it's nice to pull up the old lessons learned from 1993. And for those who really like computer history, when we pulled up those lessons, they were on a 5 1/4 plastic floppy disk on a program called Word Perfect, and the graphics were something called Harvard Graphics. So we kind of had to do a lot of computer sleuthing to be able to take that old history and put it into a format that we could use and learn from.
Wow. Wow, that's fascinating stuff. I know it when you mentioned those little disks. I remember when I deployed in the Air Force to Saudi Arabia in 92, it was before the Internet as we know it today, and instead of having regulations easily accessible live, we'd have to have our regulations on these little disks, and we'd have dozens of them, literally. It was really quite a different world than today.
Yeah, it was.
Now, I know you wrote the definitive book on the history of Fort Campbell. Before getting into maybe the highlights of that, could you tell us a bit more about the current mission of the units of Fort Campbell, and then tell us how that mission has changed over the decades?
Well, the three major units that are stationed at Fort Campbell are the 101st Airborne Division Air Assault. That's a unit with about 21,000 soldiers, and the division is specifically trained to do air assault type operations, air assault being getting to the battlefield or to the battle by the use of massed helicopters and vertical maneuver through the air. The 101st is capable of operating as a division, or any of its subordinate parts can be detached from the division and applied to a specific set of mission criteria. Recently, a year or two ago, when the Ebola outbreak was going on in Liberia, the headquarters staff of the 101st Airborne Division was deployed to Liberia and was able to use the staff skills and the leadership of the division to coordinate the efforts of a lot of medical and engineer people, units that were plugged into the division headquarters in order to help mitigate and eventually eradicate the Ebola problem in Liberia.
Wow.
So that's kind of an interesting mission set. The headquarters recently returned from Iraq, where the division was involved in helping coordinate the efforts of the Iraqi army to take back Mosul and destroy ISIS in Iraq. And one of our brigade combat teams of about 2,400 soldiers was part of that mission also. So they were able to detach from Fort Campbell and go with the division headquarters, and some other units with special capabilities were plugged into the headquarters, and they were able to have a very successful mission in support of U.S. efforts in Iraq at present. So that's the 101st Airborne Division, very, very capable, very, very flexible, and very, very mobile once it arrives on the battlefield. Task Force 160, our Special Operations Aviation Regiment that's located here, is a unit whose mission is to support the United States Defense Department's Special Operations units. And they were most famous recently. They were the unit that flew in SEAL Team 6 into bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. Extremely capable pilots, crew chiefs, mechanics, logisticians that go with them that have the best of the Army's rotary aircraft and are capable of supporting all of our conventional and non-conventional missions around the world in support of SEAL Team 6, Delta Force, the CIA, or any of the units that would require the special skills that they have. Our third unit of special note is the 5th Special Forces Group, Airborne. They're a 1,800-man unit now whose area of expertise in the world, their familiarity with the geography and culture and languages of the Middle East and Central Asia. They came to Fort Campbell in 1988, and they've been assigned with us. And because of Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Iraqi Freedom, ongoing missions in Afghanistan, that is a unit that has really been deployed almost constantly. And they're on the cutting edge. In addition to those three major units that are, you know, the units that people pay attention to because of their special skills, we also have a lot of other what we call tenant units on Fort Campbell, the 86 Combat Support Hospital, which provides medical services and combat support hospitals and theater when our units deploy. And we're we also have a explosive ordnance disposal brigade that's headquartered out of Fort Campbell also that supports explosive ordnance disposal missions throughout the entire Southeast United States and elsewhere around the world as required. So it's a very exciting place to live and work.
And it sounds like a very, very busy, you know, high demand, high deployment installation. Now, I know Fort Campbell over the decades has its mission has evolved somewhat, and it's played big roles in all the wars since World War II. I know there's a lot of history, and your book does a great job in discussing each of those time frames. Could you give us maybe some highlights of Fort Campbell's role in each of those wars?
Well, the history that we did of Fort Campbell, the name of it is A History of Fort Campbell, and what I really wanted to name it was Becoming the City of Fort Campbell, because it was intended to highlight the installation and kind of the Army sociology as opposed to the battlefield units that were so famous that trained there. So looking at the city of Fort Campbell, it came to be in 1942 as part of the mobilization effort of the United States Army for World War II. There were 61 of these giant bachelor cities that the Army put together to take an army of about 220,000 men up to an army of 8.1 million men. So housing and training and outfitting all of those soldiers was a huge task. And during World War II, the purpose of the camp, it was called Camp Campbell at the time, was to train armored forces to fight in Europe. For World War II, the Army put together 16 armored divisions. Three of those armored divisions trained at Camp Campbell. And in addition, Fort Campbell served as a place to train the individual replacements that were sent to Europe to replace the casualties of the 16 other divisions that were deployed over there. So World War II, the focus was the training of armored divisions. And as I alluded to earlier, the fact that the terrain looked like Central Europe, and very close to us we have the Cumberland River, which was about the same depth and width and flow as the Rhine River. So it provided almost a perfect setting for training for where those soldiers were going to be deployed in Europe. After the war, the big war, all of these mobilization camps were supposed to go away. And a great many of them did. There were about five or six that survived, Fort Campbell being one of them. And the reason that it survived is after the World War, and there was no longer a need for this gigantic army that we had. We went into the nuclear age, the Cold War, the atomic age, and the location where Fort Campbell was perfect for establishing one of the 13 top secret nuclear storage and weapons modification sites as nuclear weapons came online. And so an installation within the installation was built. It eventually took the name Clarksville Base. And because about one-third of the nation's nuclear capability was stored there in 1948 to 1952, as these modification sites and storage sites came online, an airborne division that fought in World War II in the Pacific, the 11th Airborne Division, was on occupation duty in Japan, and it was brought back, due to rotate, back from Japan, and it came to Fort Campbell in 1948, primarily to provide the security that would be necessary for the nuclear weapons that were there. So that's how the camp during the early Cold War ended up picking up a new life. It had a new purpose.
I see.
And all three branches of the Army, or of our armed forces at the time, the Army was there, this 11th Airborne Division. The Strategic Air Command and the United States Army Air Force, of which you're such a proud veteran, established a squadron at the airfield that became a Strategic Air Command facility. And the Navy ran the nuclear weapons site. So we had the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, all three involved together in the nuclear army of that period of time at Fort Campbell, living together, working together, and being involved in the book. I call it the National Defense City, because the purpose of our armed forces was to protect the United States during that period of the early Cold War.
Wow. I noticed a term in your book that that caught my eye. I had not heard that term before, but in the nuclear age, it was called pentomic. Is that correct? Is that how it was pronounced? It was referring to the atomic mission that you were describing.
And this is a little bit about the sociology of the Army at the time. If you recall the history from the 1950s, the United States Army got involved in the war in Korea from 1950 until about 1953-54, when the armistice came about. In the aftermath of that war, the Forgotten War, as it's often called, and a lot of our veterans were forgotten during that period of time. We certainly learned a lot about taking care of veterans in the aftermath of the war in Korea. But the Eisenhower administration was confronted with a huge national security requirement. The Soviet Army was huge, and it was a big shadow over all of Western Europe. The response that Eisenhower came up with was, number one, we would never get involved in a ground war in Asia again. So the Army had less purpose and suffered a little bit from the reputation from Korea. And it became apparent to Eisenhower that spending a lot of money on nuclear weapons for the Navy, the nuclear submarines, and for the new Air Force with its bombers, that was a better expenditure of money so we could have a smaller but more capable nuclear force. Well, the upshot for the Army during that period of time was that the Air Force and the Navy were getting all the money, and the Army was scrambling to try and find a mission. The Chief of Staff of the Army, General Maxwell Taylor, who had commanded the famous 101st during World War II, was searching for a way to make the Army relevant. And what he came up with was a way to reorganize the Army. Instead of a division being made of three regiments, two up and one back, as the Army had fought in World War II and Korea, he reorganized something called the Pentomic Formation. The Penta was from the Greek five, and the Omic was from atomic. So a pentatomic division would be made up of five very small airborne battle groups that could be deployed and spread out so that their footprint was smaller than a nuclear blast.
Wow.
In other words, they would be survivable on the nuclear battlefield. So he looked around for where to try this experiment, this pentomic experiment. He looked at Fort Campbell. Fort Campbell had, up until 1956, the 11th Airborne Division assigned there, but it had been rotated to Europe. So Fort Campbell was almost empty again, and therefore he was able to put together this experimental unit called the 101st Airborne Division Pentomic.
Ah.
And between 1956 and 1964, at Fort Campbell, they worked very hard at making the Army relevant to the nuclear battlefield, being able to deploy within 2 hours with all of its equipment anywhere in the world to establish an atomic foothold. The division itself was armed with a nuclear missile and a nuclear mortar.
Wow.
So it had its own internal nuclear capability. And the intent, of course, was that the Army would be part of this nuclear triad of forces that could be called upon if necessary.
Wow.
The experiment was a failure. The airborne battle groups were just too difficult to sustain and maintain. They tried lots of experiments with them. But that was the Army's attempt to become relevant. The Army worked very hard on long-range missiles, long-range communication, and started experimenting with something called the helicopter, which was a machine that was beginning to show some real promise for being able to add to battlefield mobility. So there was a lot of experimentation.
I'm sorry. And I guess it found a lot of success in the next war then, in Vietnam, the war of the helicopters.
Well, what had happened to the Army in between with the kind of the failure of the Pentomic experiment, John F. Kennedy became president. And John F. Kennedy looked at Eisenhower's defense strategy called the New Look that was based on massive nuclear retaliation. And Kennedy famously said in his inaugural that we would meet any threat anywhere at any time, and started to develop a defense force, the Army in particular, that would be able to match the Soviets toe-to-toe. Nikita Khrushchev had been advocating a policy of wars of national liberation and little guerrilla events and things that, you know, certainly didn't warrant the nuclear annihilation of the Soviet Union in response.
Right, right.
And so he was getting away with a whole new type of warfare. So Kennedy created the Peace Corps, the Special Forces, or the Green Beret, to handle the low end of the spectrum of conflict, and then reorganized the Army away from the Pentomic concept to be an Army capable of fighting everything from counterinsurgency all the way up to nuclear war. And that's what caused the Army to reorganize itself from airborne battle groups to a division made of a number of brigades. And for the 101st at this time, and for the 11th Air Assault Test Division at Fort Benning, the helicopters started being integrated into that. And the first time that this new, highly flexible helicopter-borne force could be used was in just one of those types of contingencies that Kennedy had envisioned, and that was a low-level insurgency going on in the country of Vietnam.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
So a new capability had been created, new doctrine, new equipment, new tactics, a new mission, and fortunately or unfortunately, there's still a lot of debate. The United States had a capability and had a mission that appeared on the horizon with the, you know, the domino theory and the communist takeover of Southeast Asia and all of that. And it made it look like it would be very possible to confront that war of national liberation with this these new types of forces and technology.
Right. Now, after Vietnam, we all know it was a very controversial war, and after the war ended in 73 and in the 70s, there was a period of time when the U.S. military really was not doing well, and the next major challenge was Operations Desert Shield, Desert Storm. I know in your book you touch upon on Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and I found it fascinating, particularly the part about the logistical preparations and the deployment. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the Army after Vietnam, or the 101st in particular, when it came back from Vietnam, had been an air mobile counterinsurgency, counter-guerrilla force. And the Nixon doctrine at the time, kind of reminiscent of the change from the Eisenhower doctrine, the Nixon doctrine said we were never going to fight a land war in Asia again. And our Army gave the mission to the 101st to make itself relevant to what Nixon considered the major threat, and that was the Soviet threat in Western Europe. So the 101st Airborne Division Air Mobile retooled, created new doctrine, and had a whole new array of extremely powerful helicopters and new technology that came on board in the mid-1980s. The rest of the Army is the same period that the M1 tank and the M2 Bradley and the Humvee, a whole vast range of new weapons technologies comes available, and of course with it the Reagan buildup of the 1980s, and so the Army really went to work learning the lessons of Vietnam and retooling itself to fight against a Soviet equipped and organized threat. That threat the Army practiced against for 15 years. It would be like if you had a football team and you knew you were going to play UCLA. You could, you know, plan for 15 years, know everything about their organization and their tactics and their command cycle and decision cycle and all of that. And then Saddam Hussein, who was equipped and trained with Soviet equipment and Soviet tactics, decided to, you know, invade and take Kuwait and threaten Saudi Arabia, and there was a response. You and I were, I think, majors at the time when all of that occurred.
I was still a captain, but yeah, I remember that time well. It was really something.
Yeah, and everybody who was serving at the time, you know, there was a great fear that this was the fourth most powerful army in the world, and we were going against them.
Yes.
We had to move the United States Army from the United States and from Europe, both which were very mature theaters, which is Army speak for, you know, all of the infrastructure was there, to a place where there was no infrastructure. It was like going to the face of the moon to be out in, you know, Saudi Arabia, in the Western desert. And with that had to come all the infrastructure for moving fuel, moving water, moving parts and equipment and men and soldiers all over the place, and they had to be moved halfway around the world. And as the Army had been training to deploy, they had not been equipping to deploy. And so a lot of the technology that the Navy needed to move forces, there was, in one instance, part of the 101st moved on a World War II ship that had been used by the division in 1969 to move it to Vietnam. And it was still in service in 1990, when the division was moved to Saudi Arabia. We had to take all of our units from Europe that deployed down to Saudi Arabia, and we were used to moving into Europe, but now we had to move out of Europe. and moved those units down into the desert. So it was quite a logistical feat, and a lot of it was done with grease pencils paper. And the Army started looking around and looked at FedEx and UPS and other places that had already started using barcode technology and satellite imagery to track shipments around the world, and the Army had to come on board very quickly to take advantage of some of those technologies to assist with the logistical move.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of great stories in your book. I think a lot of lessons. As you were researching this book, did you come across any bits of historical trivia that perhaps surprised you? I know you're a historian, but that perhaps surprised even you to learn about Fort Campbell?
As the Army was making that the transformation between those three different types of armies that we're talking about, I suppose one of the things that was most astounding to me, and it's it has to do with military sociology, was the way that the Army family matured through that period or those periods of time. Wow. It's not very exciting from a military history point of view to talk about how we house our soldiers, how we take care of their families, and those sorts of things. But that was the lessons learned about war fighting and sustaining war fighters were almost obvious.
Wow.
And what was underneath was the infrastructure that it takes to maintain our soldiers and their families. And coming with that, the work that you and Richard are doing in taking care of our veterans, that's the second part of the behind-the-scenes story about having a capable Army. Part of having a capable Army is having a capable system to take care of our veterans and put them and their families back together to sustain those that remain on active duty, to refit both the soldier and the family for the subsequent deployments, and to learn to take care of those who are wounded, both psychologically and physically.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that sums it up very well, because we see that a lot of veterans, and we've represented veterans from multiple generations, multiple wars, going back to World War II. We've had veterans come back that served in Vietnam. They said they came home and they were, it was 1 week they were in the jungle of Vietnam. The week after that, they were walking Main Street back in their hometown with very little transition help. So it has big effects also on people's, I think, willingness to join the service, how well we take care of people. John, if I could ask you one thing that I found fascinating in your book, and perhaps this is even somewhat relevant today. We've captured enemy combatants, and we've during the current war on terror, and they're housed down in Gitmo in Cuba. But I saw in your book that Fort Campbell actually had a role in World War II as overseeing a prisoner of war camp for captured German and Italian soldiers. Can you tell us a bit about that and how the local community react to that back then?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. The whole southeast of the United States was involved with taking care of about 100,000 Italian and German soldiers from World War II. And the way that we ended up with them here in the United States is the Geneva Convention, which the United States had signed in 1906, requires that you take care of enemy POWs as you would your own soldiers, in terms of housing and food and medical care. In the first part of World War II in Europe, we fought in the northern part of Africa in Sicily and took a large number of Italian and Africa Corps soldiers prisoner. And there were, essentially, in the northern part of Africa, Tunisia, Liberia, or Libya, Algeria, there was not a place and an infrastructure to take care of those prisoners adequately. the United States was sending tons and tons and tons of equipment over to England in the Liberty ships that we had built and the merchant fleet that had been put together to do that, to support the buildup for the eventual invasion in 1944. Those ships were returning to the United States empty, and someone came up with the great idea that it would be easier and safer to house those soldiers back in the United States than in North Africa, and especially not in England. England was about to sink from the amount of soldiers and equipment that we were putting there, and we certainly didn't want to put enemy soldiers at a place where they could be disruptive or where they would have a chance to escape. Right. So all across the southeast of the United States, prisoner of war camps were put in these mobilization camps, and at Fort Campbell, they ended up putting in three encampments that look like, you know, Stog Log 17 from Hogan's Heroes, wire enclosures with huts built inside them, and about 1,000 of these soldiers were housed during the war. In one camp, the recalcitrant Nazis were kept, those that were, you know, you didn't want them integrated in with the rest of the population. And in the other two encampments, one encampment had soldiers who had medical skills, and they were their skills were used legally on the wards of the hospital on the installation and with the dental clinic.
Wow.
As dental hygienists. And in the other camp, those soldiers that had skills that would be useful as warehousemen, moving supplies and equipment, especially food and replacement parts and things like that, that were coming in by train to support the units that were training at Fort Campbell. And a fourth part of that was their labor could be legally used in the local area to replace the labor of local boys who had gone to war, as long as it wasn't a war industry. And for Fort Campbell area, or Camp Campbell area at the time, tobacco production and dairy farms were places where these soldiers could be used. And it was a pretty simple system where a local farmer could come to the camp and for the cost of $2.50 get 10 soldiers and or 10 POWs and one guard. And as long as he fed them lunch and returned them by 6 o'clock in the evening, he could use their labor in the fields.
Wow.
And many of those POWs wanted to do that. Now, as far as how did the locals get along with them, in remembering the history of World War II, we did not suffer as a country a lot of casualties up until 6 June 1944 on D-Day. Prior to that, we had units that fought in the Pacific, the Marine Corps and a couple Army divisions, and we had the Army Air Corps that was conducting the bombing campaign. And we lost, and of course the battle at sea, we lost about 30,000 soldiers killed during that period of time, which is a lot of soldiers and, of course, a lot wounded. But it was relatively small when spread out across the demography of the United States at the time. During that time where losses were not huge, there did not seem to be a lot of problem with the local POWs. But once large numbers of American kids were being killed in the crusade across Europe, and then as the war in the Pacific flamed up also, the attitude towards the local prisoners changed, and there was a lot in the local newspapers, there was a lot of concern by locals that they were being mollycoddled and they were living large while local citizens' sons were dying and fighting through the winter of 1945 and 1944 and 1945.
Yeah, well, that's certainly understandable. I can see their point. I think it's just a fascinating part of history when when the United States literally was housing hundreds of thousands across the entire country. I know you mentioned earlier about the Southeast United States, but all these POWs around the country, and what a different time it was then compared to today. But
hey, John, David.
Yes.
Hey, John. John, Richard Hurley. How are you?
Hi, Richard.
Very fascinating. I've been looking at the website of Fort Campbell. I invite our listeners to, you know, to check that out. It's very interesting, all the pictures there. I have a question for you. Who have been some of the most famous soldiers who've served at Fort Campbell over the history, over its history?
Well, some of the famous characters, Charles Schultz, who was the cartoonist who did the Peanuts cartoon, was assigned to the camp during World War II. It was before he came up with his characters, but there were some interesting drawings that he did that kind of captured daily life. The man who starred in the TV series The Rifleman. Chuck Connors.
Chuck Connors.
He was quite an athlete, and he played on the basketball team at Camp Campbell. And during those war years, a lot of those sports teams were really important, and they played against local colleges and local semi-pro teams. Even the Chicago Cubs came down and played the baseball team at Fort Campbell. So Chuck Connors was a famous person. Colin Powell had served as a brigade commander at the 101st in the 1970s, and of course he went on to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and the National Security Advisor for President Reagan. Some popular culture characters included Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses. It served at Fort Campbell, as did Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
Jimi Hendrix got his start, really, playing at one of the clubs at Fort Campbell.
Wow. John, I hate to interrupt. It's been a fascinating show. Thanks to you. We're about running out of time, so I wanted, before you leave, I wanted you to please tell listeners how they can purchase a copy of your book, A History of Fort Campbell.
It's available at Amazon.com. Again, the name is enter books, A History of Fort Campbell, and it pops right up. It has, one of the things I'm really proud about is does have a very nice review by you of the book. And the part of the story is related to our veterans and taking care of our families and our soldiers and our veterans community. And I certainly thank you for the work that you're doing that. And I hope any veterans who served at Fort Campbell would enjoy reading a little bit about the history of their city, and feel very welcome to come back and visit with us this coming May. We'll be celebrating the Week of the Eagles, a week-long celebration where we honor the service of our veterans by inviting them onto the installation, and come back and see how things have changed and how the city continues to grow and meet the needs of our nation.
Well, thanks so much, John. And perhaps if you'd be interested, we'd like to have you back on the show again sometime soon. We're about out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for listening tonight to our show on BBS Radio. We'll be back next Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. And you can listen to our archived podcast of prior shows on the website bbsradio.com/TheVeteransNewsHour. We'd like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Doug Newsom, for the great job he's done, and invite listeners to become show guest sponsors and advertisers for our show. You can contact me, David Corey, at 813-662-0760. Again, that's 813-662-0760. Or Richard Hurley, 727-612-1515. Again, 727-612-1515. And that's our show for tonight. Please tune in next week for another great show.
Thanks again, John.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.